Your boyfriend's an asshole.
He's not an asshole. He's honest. If anyone's an asshole, I am for lying.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week, we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Thanks for listening to Still Queer as Folk. If you take a minute to click that subscribe button right now, you'll never miss an episode.
You can like us on Facebook as Still Queer as Folk and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Still Queer AF.
This episode is called Out with a Whimper. It's the season finale of season two.
We're finally here.
It's been a long road.
A very long road. It first aired in the U.S. on June 16th, 2002.
It was directed by David Wellington, his fifth of eight episodes. I tend to really like his episodes, no matter who wrote them, even Karen Walton.
Still throwing shade to Karen Walton. Out with the Whimper was written by executive producers Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman, and they also wrote the teleplay, which is pretty rare for the producing team.
Here's a recap of Out with a Whimper from Queer as Folk, the book.
It's time for the rage release party, but few people feel like celebrating.
Justin apologizes to Brian about Ethan, but then gets into a fight with Michael over the situation.
Ben announces that he's leaving for Tibet, but will only go if Michael is okay with it. Michael reluctantly gives his blessing, but Debbie convinces Ben to stay.
Ted admits feelings to an unreceptive Emmett. However, upon further consideration, Emmett changes his mind and locks lips with his friends.
They like deep tongue is what
friend.
They do.
I said friends.
And in the end, Justin makes his choice to go with the romantic Ethan, leaving Brian behind.
The romantic Ethan. Whew. Fiddle player. So the A story here involved Justin, Ethan, Brian, Michael, everybody that you'd expect. Something I found interesting about this opening scene was that Brian launched an ad campaign for Rage, all without consulting Michael and Justin, the creators.
I've invited members of the gay press and set up some interviews, bought advertising and all the fag rags, top queer websites. If we play this right, you won't be able to peddle these fast enough.
He just did this whole thing, party, everything, all the gay magazines.
I want to know who is bankrolling the whole production. I understand that
Brian is.
Okay, so Brian is the producer. He is the publisher. He is the
impresario.
as the inspiration for Rage, I reserve all copyright to produce this comic book, because that's something I feel like was very much just kind of overshadowed, because next thing you know, they have a box of their first issue.
Justin and Michael seemed totally shocked that Brian had done all this, and I couldn't help but thinking, if you're making a comic book, wouldn't you want some kind of creative control over the in real life version of your work? But Brian just goes with it.
He's like Stefan from the SNL skit that Bill Hader does. Like, the hottest comic book in Pittsburgh is Rage. But I also love how this episode opens with them opening the box and seeing their first, issue in print. And Michael is very buddy-buddy with Justin, even though the last episode ended with him very strongly hinting at Brian that there is an issue with Justin and possibly another man beyond the situation that they have set up for themselves.
Yeah, well, Michael all but told him that something's going on, so.
Yes, but now it's like, oh, let's not worry about that now because our first issue is here.
There was this subtle little moment when Justin was leaving the comic store and Brian kind of stares into space and says,
"See it tonight, Usher."
So that was the moment where Brian is kind of putting him on notice, like, yeah, something's going on here. I'm wise to you. I'm onto it. So let the fight for Justin begin. Fight over the twink.
Yes. It's like Mortal Kombat.
Yeah. Justin and Ethan were in bed together, and whoo, I like those scenes.
Their
sex scenes are always so cuddly versus Brian's whip it off, shove it in, grunt and groan, and then go back to what you're doing.
Dare I say, I feel like the sex scenes with Brian are a little dull now.
Yeah, I think that the writers and the director have been doing that on purpose in order to show that Ethan and Justin are better in bed, for the moment anyway.
For the moment, and that they are connecting in a way that even in the early sex scenes between Brian and Justin, Justin and Ethan are connecting in a way that I don't think Brian and Justin ever have.
Totally. And if they were connecting, it was definitely unsaid.
Very much so. And I love what Ethan says here.
He must love you a lot.
In his way.
But not in yours.
And I just loved that.
Well, I bumped on that because it seems like tearing down the current boyfriend is a bad approach for an interloper trying to take his place.
I don't know if he's necessarily tearing him down, but I think he was pinpointing the doubt that is happening in the relationship.
Yeah, but it's because
Ethan at this point has not met Brian.
But it's not his place to be doing that. He needs to win Justin on his own merit, not because he can pitch himself as being better than Brian.
Well, and I don't think he's doing that. I don't think he's saying that he's better than Brian. He's at least able to put a label as to what's going on between Brian and Justin.
Yeah, fair enough. He did invite Justin to go to the country with him, like drive to the country. So I started to think, which one of them has a car? Neither of them.
That's very true. How are they going to, are they just going to take the train? Is that
we know
a thing?
That Justin doesn't have a car. We saw him drive, I think, exactly once. And that was the station wagon in season one.
Yes.
When Sherry Miller says, Justin, do you have a boyfriend?
So do you have a boyfriend, Justin?
And he hits the brakes. and then like jumps out and runs for it. So I thought that line was a little corny. It's not like they can rent a car or call an Uber, or I don't think there's a bus in Pittsburgh that takes them to the country.
That's very true, because they are under 25. So I don't know how they would be able to rent a car.
I thought it was cute that Ethan dedicated his homemade CD to Justin and then even stole Justin's drawing for the CD.
When Ethan says, look on the back, I thought he was going to say like illustration by, like I thought he was going to give him a credit. He's like, no, he just dedicated. I was like, maybe Justin should look into the copyright.
Since when did Ethan busk, I guess is the word, play the fiddle on the street on Liberty Avenue in front of the diner? That's not his corner. That's not his scene. He's not known as a Liberty Avenue person.
Well, where were Michael and Justin putting up their posters? Because I thought that was on Liberty Avenue.
Oh, I was pretty sure that was at Justin and Ethan's school.
It was at least nearby.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't a business district. There were like parklands.
Maybe one of our listeners can help with the geography of Pittsburgh in this show. Because I don't think it quite tracks, because it makes it sound like there's Liberty Avenue, but the school still happens to be right there, as well as the diner, as well as where Brian lives, as well as...
And Daphne's biology school, as we pointed out last
time. Yes, it's like they're all within the same radius each other.
All within walking distance. No public transport necessary. Just walk.
Right. And so here we have Brian intercepting with Ethan on the corner.
So wait a minute. How did Brian know who he was?
Whoa.
So I thought maybe he found one of Ethan's CDs in the loft. The first CD that we see Ethan give Justin, it's a picture of Ethan on the corner, fantastic pose with his violin. So where's Justin hiding these anyway?
And now I want to go back to when Michael Alba tells Brian, because we know that Michael knows what Ethan looks like.
Yeah, but when he was telling Brian, he never really came flat out and said it. He just says, well, what if there was someone else? It was this really, really nice double entendre that Michael and Brian were dancing around as Michael's trying to tell him. Michael never really came right out and said, he's seen a violin player.
Now I want to go back from the second Ethan was introduced to see how it's possible that Brian would know.
I also thought that this was Conan Lippman giving Brian a superpower. and that's something that when we interviewed Blair Fell back, geez, it seems like months ago, he talked about how Conan Lippman always had a very specific Brian character in mind, and that he could do things that sort of defied logic in a lot of cases in order to show that he's Brian Kinney. He can do anything.
Yeah, isn't that one of Rage's powers? They can figure
read
out
minds.
Well, he can read which one are gay. He had like incredible gaydar. Am I wrong? Maybe that's what it is.
It was such a big contrast between Brian and Ethan at the diner. We have Brian, who's very well-dressed. He's an ad executive, full of confidence. And then we
arrogance.
Have... Ethan, the scruffy music student, unable to kind of see through the stranger's machinations.
Yeah, so he doesn't understand why Brian wants to help him make more money. It sounds like he wants to pitch him to be in commercials and something.
Yeah, this had like a dirty old man moment.
Yes.
If you're a 19-year-old violinist and you're playing for cash on Liberty Avenue and somebody dressed like Brian drops $100 into your case and then invites you into the diner and then wants to hire you.
It's a very indecent proposal.
Yeah.
$1 million for you to play in my commercial.
Yeah, right. This whole scorpion dance between Brian and Ethan was just crazy, though. If I was Justin, I would think that Brian had gone completely around the bend. This is like weird stalker psychotic behavior.
And this is not the first moment that we're going to bring up the whole stalker syndrome in this episode.
This is breakup material. If somebody did that to me, it would be done. It's like, how dare you like stalk me that way?
Yes. And as
I know you're right, but...
But what the hell, man?
You're creepy.
But Justin comes in and sees the two of them meeting. Of course, Ethan is able to put it together because he, I guess, knows that Justin's boyfriend is Brian Kenny. I feel like that introduction.
Did he know the name?
Well, that's the thing. When Brian hands him his card, he says, "My name is Brian. Brian Kenny.
Bond. Almost, James Bond."
Almost like to wink that he is the boyfriend because Ethan pieces it together.
Yeah, and I loved the way that Fab Filippo played that off. He didn't say anything. He just kind of looked back and forth. You could see the gears turning in his head. And he's like, "What the fuck am I in the middle of?"
Yep.
And then Justin walks in and just the look on his face was like priceless. The thing that I thought was funny,
he was dumbfounded.
He didn't recognize Ethan from behind, though.
Like,
So
come on.
Justin's never knelt behind Ethan.
Maybe they've been doing it missionary so they could see each other face to face.
Yeah.
They want to like lock
They're
eyes.
In love.
Yeah.
I did think that Justin got it right, though, when he apologized to Brian because he didn't critique Brian's stalker tactics. Instead, he was apologizing for letting it carry on too long. And I thought that was good writing there.
"I'm sorry."
"What for?"
"You know what for. I didn't mean for it to happen."
"I know. You were the poor, hapless victim of a love bashing.
I should have told you about it.
I'm taking all the fun out of it."
Ordinarily, you would have done what I did, which is, how dare you stalk me? How dare you do this? Why would you like go up to him? You know, you make
you
it
would
less
be on the defensive right away.
Not the defensive so much, but I don't think I would instinctively focus on the core issue, which is that Justin had fallen for somebody else and Justin knew it. And he apologized essentially for letting it go on too long. Most people, I think, would get into Brian for being a creeper.
That's sort of like deflecting it, saying like, "Yes, I fell for someone, but why were you doing this and this and this?"
Right.
Trying to push it back on him.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the natural thing, but this is why I like the writing, because Justin didn't do that. He went right to the core. Yeah. It's perfect.
"There are other things.
Flowers. Picnics. Violin music.
He loves me.
Your dreamy-eyed schoolboy.
In ways that you can't.
In ways that I won't.
He told me that I'm all he wants."
"They're still using that one?"
"It's more than you've ever said."
"And it's more than I ever will, so, what the fuck are you still doing here?"
"Would you care if I wasn't?"
"It's your call where you want to be. You decide."
There's such a conflict going on with Brian. He wants Justin to stay with him, but he also just won't knock down his well-polished character. He can't seem to let go of this thing that he's polished for so long.
This was my big question with the tactic that Brian was employing here is, what is his end game? I mean, is he calling Justin's bluff about leaving and going to Ethan instead, or has all this...
I think he definitely wants him to stay. He just doesn't know how to say it. This goes back to his mother, who was very cold, didn't really give him any affection. And then his dad that was pretty much abusive to him. So I don't think that Brian is really all that comfortable or really knows how to be vulnerable to somebody. So he's leaving it entirely up to Justin to decide where he wants to be, which I thought was really weak. You would expect somebody like Brian to come out and say, I want you. I need you in my life.
He would be putting up some kind of fight, but it's as if he doesn't know how. He's not used to this. He's not used to having to actually fight for getting what he wants.
Exactly. He just gets it. Ethan didn't hold back about this either.
Your boyfriend's an asshole.
He's not an asshole. He's honest. If anyone's an asshole, I am for lying.
How did he find out?
I don't know.
You didn't ask him?
He'd never tell me.
Well, you can tell him from me that he can keep his fucking donation to the arts.
So he's sort of waking up Justin to Brian's game. I did like that. He told Justin to take a hike. He's like, get out of here. Go back to your boyfriend. There were no games. He is totally decisive.
Yes.
So this was the exact opposite of what Brian was doing. Brian was not being decisive. He wasn't coming out and telling Justin how he felt and what he wanted. Ethan's just like, get the fuck away from me.
I can't be worried about thinking about you knowing that you're never going to stay. I loved that. And, mm-hmm. and Justin is trying to, and me, I said, no, I'll stay. It always felt like it was just like, I'm just saying this to make you happy, to end right. this fight. I'm going to say what you want to hear, but Ethan doesn't buy any of it. And I just go back to playing. I watch these episodes with captioning and I love that as soon as Ethan says, I'm going to go back to my violin and he starts, says aggressively playing violin, it was a very charged, passionate piece that he was playing. It was beautiful. It really fit the moment of tension that now it felt like Justin is now going back only because Ethan rejected him.
I thought it was a little hokey that he did aggressive violin playing. It was a little expected. Like,
oh, sure.
Like, let me rescore this moment here. Curiously, when Justin gets back to the loft, he gets into bed with Brian.
As if it was, when Justin arrives back into the loft, to me, it almost read like defeat.
Yeah, I didn't see defeat. I saw Justin not having any option. Ethan had just kicked him out and said, get out of here, get back to your boyfriend. Justin didn't put up a fight. Where else would he go? The only place that he's gone in the past is Debbie's house or the lesbians. He goes back to Brian's loft, and this was a dynamite scene here from David Wellington, where Brian lifts the duvet, invites him in, puts his arm around him, and there's no music. There's just slight environmental sounds. In the silence, we just see millions of things going through both of their minds.
It's a small push in on their face. So all we see, and the fact that neither one of them is looking at each other, not understanding that both of them are showing signs of uncertainty, of doubt, not knowing whether or not the right choice has been made.
It's very telling that they're not facing each other and not saying anything, because if they just rolled over and looked in each other's eyes,
it would say everything they needed to say.
Yeah. I think Justin should have slept on the sofa, though, when he got back, because Brian acted crazy, and there should have been a little bit more of a separation between the two of them. Justin had owned up to it, and he had said, I'm sorry that things had gone this far, but at some point he's got to be mad at Brian. And I think this was a moment that he should have been mad, and he should have made Brian sleep alone. Brian has put him on the sofa before, so...
That's very true. But in Brian's house, Justin should make the decision to sleep on the sofa himself rather than say, Brian, I'm taking the bed.
I like that better. There was some good dialogue here where Justin is talking to Michael and...
We have an interview with Pittsburgh Owl. Couldn't you have dressed up a little?
I'm an artist, not a businessman. I don't need to wear a suit and tie to impress anyone.
This is for Brian. He went to a lot of trouble for us.
It's not for us. It's for him. Brian calls all the shots. Brian controls the show, including us.
If you ask me, he's been pretty good to you. I mean, he saved your life. Took you in. He's putting you through school. He protects you. Looks after you.
This was all set up for you and Justin. This should be about you. It should not be about Brian, Michael, for once in your fucking life. It's not about Brian. Oh, it was so frustrating watching Michael in this scene for me.
Well, apparently these were Michael's trigger points. He just launches into Brian saved your life. He took you in, is putting you through school. Dude, MYOB.
Mind your own fucking business.
Yeah.
So when Justin tells him to stop putting your nose in it. It's not your business. And Michael's counter was, Brian is my business. He's my best friend. And I was like, oh.
Haven't heard that in a while.
Are you out of your goddamn mind, Michael?
It was
live
enough,
your own life.
This was enough to really heighten that simmering tension between the two of them. So that I saw that part of the scene as just a warm-up to start to build a little bit of headbutting there, because what Michael says next is really the denouement of the moment.
Whether you believe it or not, he loves you more than he's ever loved anyone.
He doesn't love me. He fucks me.
Well, then why don't you find somebody else? Maybe you already have.
So that's the moment that Justin realizes that Michael ratted him out. Was Michael defending Brian enough for him to drop that bomb? Because it seems like he should have taken that one to the grave. Like, don't, Michael, don't ever tell anyone that you outed Justin.
100%.
Just keep it to yourself. You don't have to twist that knife.
No, he decided to use it as ammo because he's being petty in the moment. And I like that Justin stood up for himself, called him out on it, and just said, fine, I am done, and just walked out.
Yeah, do you think that Justin was right to get that angry, though, and stomp
Hell
off?
Hell yes, because it's a betrayal.
But this is of Michael. Someone who is, it's not like he has a deep vested interest in the Michael relationship.
No, it's more of a betrayal from the... I see it more as a betrayal from the creative partner side. Not necessarily the tenuous friendship that existed between Justin and Michael. Yeah. Not that... because it felt like they had reached a truce in that, okay, Justin's going to be around and you're going to have to fucking deal with it. That now that they have this creative partnership and they have equal stakes in the Rage comic book, why would Justin want to stick around with that if he feels like he can't trust his creative partner?
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. Because when he stopped off, I was just like, It contradicted what I talked about before, where Justin was on point in talking about the root cause versus the causality around it, the things that surround it. Let's talk about this Rage release party.
Yes.
I think David Wellington really nailed the scene. It was 12 minutes long.
It's a big thing.
That's
they
a quarter
have,
of the episode.
They have a live version of the comic book, which looked pretty good. Yeah, the fact that this was staged at a club, I was rather impressed. You know, they have this MC. They have someone who clearly is supposed to be Justin, and then Rage and Zephyr, you know, coming in to save the day. And everyone is like wearing masks and everything. Like, it was an elaborate party.
Every major character was in this scene.
Even Jennifer and Daphne.
They were. They should have.
They were there to celebrate the comic book too, which made me really happy.
So I did notice that there were very few women there. So there was Jennifer, Daphne, Melanie, Lindsay, Debbie. I think those are the only females that you see in the entire scene.
Apparently in Pittsburgh, these are the only females that exist.
Certainly at Babylon. It was nice to see Vic at Babylon dancing and kind of getting his groove on.
Having a good time now that he's alive again.
Justin and Michael are standing, not talking to each other. Brian's got his arms around both of them. Do you think that Brian thought that Justin was back?
I think so. I'm going to say yes to that. And I think that's only because that was the choice that was left. He doesn't have, at that point, Justin doesn't have Ethan anymore. So that's
but
the only
Brian
reason.
Wouldn't know that. Do you think that Brian believed that Justin had chosen him though? Who do you think? Where's Brian's
head?
That
is the more interesting question, because based on that last shot that we see of them in bed, as an audience, we don't know that answer.
I think we do, though, because Justin left. He went to Ethan's. Ethan kicked him out. He went back to Brian. Brian and Justin get into bed in their undies and cuddle and look blankly into space, 1,000-yard stares. So I'm kind of led to believe that Brian thought that he was back, that he had won.
That is the question, because later on in the party, we see Justin looking for Brian, and Mel and Lindsay are like speaking. They're really kind of talking Brian up, saying like, he's been looking for you. You know, he's here to celebrate for you, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Go find him in the back room.
And as Justin goes back, he goes in and of course finds Brian fucking Rage.
Yeah. That was predictable. Ordinarily, that's exactly what we would think Brian would do.
And the
he
thing,
fucked Captain Astro
and the thing
in season
that,
one.
Yes. And the thing that like made me think about this even more is Brian is the inspiration for Rage. He is literally fucking himself. And if that is not the epitome of the narcissism that we have come to expect from Brian, after all this discussion we thought you have had with Justin and understanding his frustration and why he went to Ethan and what he was searching for, and that maybe you were possibly going to meet him halfway, it should not be a fucking surprise that Justin saw that and was like, I'm out.
Well, I did see that Justin had kind of a sly little smile on his face when he saw
that
Brian
was
banging him.
I read that as like, of course you fucking are. I'm leaving. It was more of like, of course you have the gall to do this.
I don't think Justin's mind was made up at that point.
Oh, I do. I think 100% at that point he at least made up his mind that he was done with Brian.
That's kind of a stretch because Ethan was out of the picture.
Ethan was out of the picture doesn't mean that Justin is thinking, I'm going to think of for myself right now.
I don't know is that it was that definitive. I think he was still not entirely sure what was going on, and he saw a hot moment with Brian.
Yeah, we're definitely reading that smirk as very different things. So you're seeing the smirk as more like he was turned on by it?
Yeah, I didn't call it a smirk. I called it a smile.
Oh, I thought you had said, I definitely don't think he was turned on. That was him saying, Brian is more never like, going to change. Yeah, it was more of a scoff to me.
Oh, I saw it as,
No, not in the least did I think Justin was in any way. Because then everything that has been proceeding up to this moment doesn't make sense for Justin to be questioning everything that he's had with Brian.
Well, I think he had made his decision the night before and he was staying with Brian. At this point, Ethan was out of the picture, so he just didn't seem to have really gone one hard way or the other. He was just kind of still there, still rolling along with Brian. The thing that really made this scene was a Bjork song, which was playing. It's called Human Nature. I really like that. Props to Ethan for walking into the lion's den of this party. First, he realized that he didn't want Justin out of his life, so he was going to go find him. He knew where he'd be. The second, because he went to Babylon, which is most definitely not his home field.
Yes, he has said explicitly how much he does not go out to the party scene. He doesn't go to the clubs. He doesn't involve himself in that at all.
Yeah, I thought that was gutsy for him to show up there.
Especially at a party that he knows that likely Brian is going to be there.
Oh, yeah.
So that could be a total thing, too. Like, could there be a physical fight for Justin? Who knows?
But man, did Ethan really deliver the goods on Justin's?
I was practicing the Beethoven. It sounded like shit, and I realized it's all your fault.
My fault?
I tried to forget about you, but I can't. You're all I think about.
That kiss in front of everyone. I kind of had to suspend disbelief for just a brief moment here, since everybody else had basically encircled the two of them so we could get the reaction shots and get our favorite characters in the background, which just wouldn't happen in a crowded club.
No, yeah. Someone would be at the bar. Someone would be over here. Yeah. Someone would be over there. Yeah.
So everybody saw this, which was okay. It had to happen that way on TV. You've got seven other characters that need to fall into the picture in some place. I did like that Ethan caught sight of Brian staring at them making out. It's Ethan that kind of went,
Yes, that was a look of, your boyfriend is over there.
Yeah, it just added so much risk.
And I think that also, in a way, what I was seeing was Ethan then putting the onus back on Justin to make a decision. Because Ethan doesn't do anything. He doesn't do anything physical to say, like, Justin is mine. He doesn't try to approach Brian. He doesn't do anything. He sort of gives the look and lets Justin figure out where he needs to go from here.
Yeah, he had said everything that he needed to say, yep. Which is, you're all that I think about. I can't exist without you, and I need you. That's, at the end of the day, all that you can say. It was very wise of the young fiddle player to know that and to act that way. Brian looked genuinely hurt, maybe for the first time in this show. But then it was business as usual for him. He just grabs the nearest hot guy and starts grinding
on him. And starts dancing and everything. But then the camera stays with him.
Where was it supposed to go? Daphne?
No. And that, I feel like, as you said, he's hurt. And I think on the surface, it's business as usual. Yeah, he finds the next hot guy. But the fact that it lingers, I feel we see that uncertainty again. And I think we see that hurt again.
It almost felt to me like Brian was becoming a villain.
Believe me when I say he's not becoming a villain. He's not so much a villain. He's very much an anti-hero.
Well, what about Brian 2.0 and Brian 2.5 that we talked about in the last several episodes?
The last, like,
Brian three, rehabilitating
no, ever
Justin.
Ever since Ethan has entered the picture, Brian has sort of been the antagonist of the story, at least from my perspective, and in terms of seeing the storyline through Justin's eyes.
Well, which is interesting because he's the one that got cheated on, but he's the villain. like a Breaking Bad type of thing. You want the anti-hero to win.
And while, yes, he is the cuckold in this instance, I don't feel bad for Brian.
Oh, I kind of did.
I don't. Because Justin, I think, was very explicitly clear in saying, this is what I'm missing. He apologized and again said, but are you prepared to give me what I'm looking for? Because really, it's Justin giving and giving and giving and Brian taking and taking and taking. Where's the balance in this?
I don't know if it was that explicit. Justin had kind of beat around the bush for quite a while on that. And it only comes out in little drips and drabs, like the time that he tried to have the picnic on the floor. And he's saying, would you miss me if I wasn't here?
As Justin and Brian are trying to have it out now that Ethan the whole relationship between Justin and Ethan has been exposed. Justin points out that Ethan loves him in ways that Brian can't, and Brian counters that saying that I won't. So then to me, that's Brian making a very clear distinction and saying that, no, I'm not going to give you that, and you should never expect that from me.
Yeah, which is fair enough, but how does that make Brian like the anti-hero? He's being honest.
But to me, that tells me that he's not willing to do anything to fight for the relationship. He's saying like, well, I'm never going to change, so why bother? And to me, I feel like that then throws away all of anything that we've built up in this couple, from the fact that Brian was emotionally devastated by Justin's bashing and was willing to step up and be the support that Justin needs through all that. And I'm like, is that all for nothing? I don't understand why then it felt like Brian just kind of gave up on the whole thing.
What's interesting with Brian and Justin is that there is so much that's unsaid. There is a lack of honest communication between the two of them.
100%. Yes.
As a result, as viewers, we see one side of Brian that suggests that he just can't say these things. It doesn't mean that he's not feeling them, though. But in television, you have to spoon feed this a little bit more. You have to make these logical jumps that says, well, if he's not saying it, he's not feeling it. But we know that he is feeling this. We know that he does have these feelings for Justin. He just can't get it out. He can't find the words. He can't find the change in ego to be able to say these things. But I don't think for a minute that he doesn't believe it.
I think right there you've pinpointed on what makes Brian such a frustrating character to me is that he can't get beyond his ego and think of someone else for once in his life.
Well, I think about what the causality is of the ego. And again, it goes back to Mr. and Mrs. Kinney.
Well, his dad is dead. So at some point, I feel like Brian has to now grow up.
True, but a dead parent is sometimes a much louder voice than a living parent because it's done. There's no chance of ever changing it. But sure, he needs to evolve. He needs to be in therapy. He needs to work out these issues.
Exactly. It's like as so many of the problems that we had with Michael in the first season of being very much emotionally immature and emotionally stunted.
Yeah.
Especially in his relationship. That's where I feel like Brian is now. Like there's nowhere for him to go.
Sure. And I still give him credit for having these feelings for Justin, though. And I don't think that he's always doing this deliberately. It's just limitations of himself that he is unable to overcome because he's not willing to do anything to try to overcome it, like therapy.
Fair.
Seeing Justin leave with Ethan was a really nice, tidy cliffhanger, though, for season two. The last cliffhanger we had, there was baseball bat,
blood,
ambulances,
slow motion, there might as well have been doves. Yeah.
Yeah, so I like this nice, tidy little cliffhanger because it leaves us with the notion that, oh, this show's going to go in a new direction. If you're a Justin fan, you're like, yes, Justin's finding a hot little boyfriend. If you're a Brian fan, you're like, yes, return to the Brian of old. So there's a little bit of the cliffhanger for everybody. And it wasn't like a tearjerker like season one. I think I remember telling you in when we podcasted that episode about how I'd watched it in a bar and there was this big gasp and people crying and everything after Justin got bashed. And then, of course, like the episode ends, there's no closing music. Actually, there was. It was just a somber music. But they cut it off and then go right into like a disco song. And so
we're like, and let's get to our dance party.
Yeah, people are still like all teary-eyed and everything. Here it had almost like an optimistic note to it, which I liked.
It was melancholy, but because of the mood of the environment that they were in, because of Babylon, it made it a little cleaner, or a little, as you said, optimistic, a little brighter, I should say.
I think the characters, the surrounding characters that didn't have a problem with it, really added something to the scene too. So Daphne was just kind of like, ah! And really the only two that were kind of like anti Justin here, I think, was Michael and I guess Brian.
Yeah, that's
everybody
it.
Else was just kind of like,
I mean, how many times have all those other characters taken their turn at smacking Brian down? Yeah. At this point, you might as well have expected him to line up
the airplane scene
and have every character start smacking him around again. Yeah,
I love it when you bring up that analogy. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will talk about Ben and Michael and Tibet.
Are you following us on Twitter, Instagram? Check us out at Still Queer AF.
This is Still Queer as Folk, and there's more to come. It's another dinner at Debbie's house.
Only this time, Ben is much more included.
There's something here that I bumped up on, which Michael tells the story about how the family goes to the Poconos every year.
Mm-hmm.
But in season one, Michael made a big deal out of getting out of the city for the first time when he and Dr. David spent the weekend in the country.
Where's the continuity in this series?
Remember, it's Dr. David had said something like, haven't you ever left the city before? And
God, how good fresh air smells.
When was the last time you were in the country?
We visited a dairy in the third grade.
That's a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like
Michael said we went to a dairy in the third grade. And so,
but apparently here they've always gone to the Poconos right. For 2 weeks.
Exactly. I pick up on these little things here.
I love that.
So Ben announces that he's going to go away for 6 months in front of Debbie and Vic.
And Michael. Michael was definitely not aware in this moment either.
Yeah, it seems like something like that should be a more private discussion with Michael instead of bringing it up in front of the family.
Absolutely. It would have been like, Michael, so I have been thinking and there is this program and I would, if I accepted, I would go to Tibet for 6 months. How do you feel about that?
He'd be there like what, a couple weeks or?
Well, it's an intensive program. So if I decide to go more like 6 months.
Hal Sparks had these just god awful reaction shots throughout that entire scene. Every time there's a cutaway to him, he's just kind of munching and smiling and going, with the Cro-Magnon spoon.
Yes, yeah. His caveman grip eating the food.
I was excited to see that the social gym is back. We haven't talked about the social gym in a long time.
I also love the fact that they managed to find four Stairmasters all next to each other.
Oh, yeah, synchronized Stairmaster routines.
In order to have this conversation with each other. I was very impressed because that doesn't exist in the real world. No way in hell would you find two together, let alone four.
Two Stairmasters together?
Where you and your friends could all be going together.
Yeah,
like no way.
Group session, almost like a spin class.
Exactly.
This was really just kind of a little transitionary scene to give us some hints about Ted falling for Emmett. They needed to be in the gym. They needed to have their clothes off. They needed to be together. The rest was just kind of like fillers. I thought it was cute when Michael was visiting Ben at his university, though.
Yes, and saw that Rage was already on the reading list for his class.
So Ben gets accepted to the monastery and says he won't go without Michael's blessing and approval. I bumped on that too. Again, it's like, how long have these guys been dating?
I mean, considering they've now gone through a near-death experience with each other, I feel like that bumps their relationship
at like
up
month
further.
Six or whatever?
Yeah.
I guess it's possible at month six, if your new beau is suddenly hospitalized with pancreatitis, that you would go to the hospital or something.
Yes, and then you have decided that, like, that shows that you're in it for the long haul.
Yeah. I just felt like their relationship really accelerated this season, sort of like how Dr. David Cameron did in season one. That whole season was pretty much their relationship going from 0 to 60.
And as Michael points out, it feels like it's like the cosmos saying that, oh, you're falling in love? Great. Let's send this guy out.
Yeah. Great bedroom scene with Michael and Ben, though. I know that you love it when Ben takes his clothes off.
Correct.
So there is what I thought was a pretty mature conversation going on here. Michael finally realizes that Ben leaving isn't about him and that Ben needs to do what Ben needs to do and gives his approval. That was a rare moment of maturity from Michael, and I liked it.
And I think what helped that conversation was the conversation that he has with Debbie and Vic. Because Vic is the only one who can really say, I have been in Ben's position.
Mm-hmm.
I almost died. And when I managed to somehow crawl my way back, I knew that I had to take the opportunity and do what I wanted to do because life can be limited. And I think that helped because then Michael is able to balance the conversation that Debbie is having and saying that, what about all the logistics of what if something happens while he's away? What are the hospitals like? How quickly could he get there? Who's going to be there to help him? All of those legitimate questions. And then for Vic to say, but then is Ben going to just live his life in fear? And is that any way to live? So I think that helps Michael in trying to contemplate the decision that Ben puts before him.
I thought it was cute that Debbie is treating Ben better.
Yes, I really loved that heart to heart. She's like bringing him into the fold.
I had some problems with that.
Look, Debbie, you know better than anyone. He would have an easier ride.
Who says it loves an easy ride? General Motors? Michael's used to bumps. He grew up with me. So if you think you're doing him a favor by leaving, there's no need. My son's strong. He's strong enough to see anything through. The question is, are you?
At first, I didn't know what was going on. Was Debbie trying to tell him not to leave? I didn't follow it.
Well, that's what's crazy, because like when we were reading this, the summary from the book, the book says that Debbie convinces Ben to stay, but I don't think necessarily she convinces him, but she gives him more food for thought.
Yeah, I thought the writing here was super awkward. She says that Michael is strong and can see anything through. And at that moment, I was like, no. That's so not the Michael that we've seen in
like,
these
we're
first
not doing
two seasons.
This here.
Michael is pretty much a mess. And he doesn't know himself. He jumps into the middle of Brian and Justin.
Brian is his business.
Yeah. I just don't get this notion that Michael can get through anything. Michael just seems like he's going to fall apart any minute.
Yes, he is. I think he is still very fragile.
Plus, honestly, 6 months is not a long time to ask somebody to wait. When you have a really strong connection with somebody, it's going to endure. I didn't get that. It's like, dude, wait.
Yeah, and it's not any surprise that this has always been on Ben's mind to go to Tibet. Like, this has been known.
It's only 6 months. I mean, come on.
Six months fly by, really. I mean, look at this. We're already in August of 2018.
Ben could have been to Tibet and back by now.
Yep, there you go.
I didn't get why Ben just didn't go to Tibet. His reason of, I already have what I need and don't need to go to Tibet to find it?
Yes.
Well, does that make Michael like the savior?
No, it was very much like, oh, I was never going to go. I just needed to know that you would let me. Like, what? No,
Debbie
we're not
would let me.
Stop it. No way.
Yeah, I thought this little story was kind of weak. I don't think it needed to be in this episode. I don't think that it moved their story that much further along.
Yeah,
it never comes back up.
I would have much rather preferred it be a storyline that helps pull Michael back away from sticking his nose in Brian and Justin's business.
Yeah.
It doesn't really do that.
Right.
It just allows there to be one more little conflict that gets wrapped up very nicely in the 42 minutes of this episode.
This is Still Queer as Folk, and we'll be right back.
We hope you're loving the episode, and why don't you show us that love with 5 stars on Apple Podcasts.
So the social gym again, synchronized Stairmaster routines, and then Ted gets like super creepy.
Oh, hold on.
What?
Your back's still wet. Let me dry you off.
Oh.
Well, Em, you've really gotten yourself in a great shape. Your back is as broad as Texas, stomach as flat as Kansas, and Florida is lovely this time of year.
Oh, let me dry you off. Well, Emmett, you look good.
Even just on the Stairmaster, not even on the synchronized Stairmaster, Ted was very, very weird. Oh, you're so funny, Emmett.
Yeah.
You're so funny. I was like, what the hell is going on?
Well, I thought it was written really well, though, because it's that awkward moment when you like somebody and you just trip up all over yourself talking to them or even like thinking about them. You're just so like, I'm so into you. And you just,
I just saw it as so obvious. Like there was not even a hint of subtlety in trying to do what you're describing that I was like, is Emmett really that blind to not understand what's going on?
Well, it took Melanie and Lindsay to really detect it in Ted.
Oh, and they saw it right away.
He's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. It's Meshuggah, huh?
Not that Meshuggah.
So what happened to Mel and me? One day we're friends and
next thing you know, we're lovers.
Yeah, but you're lesbian, so.
Oh, friends turn into lovers all the time.
Even fags. So go for it. Tell him how you feel.
You never know. You might just awaken some feelings in him.
I thought it was curious that they were in favor of Ted pursuing him.
Yes, where did this come from? Because we all know how Ted felt about Michael at the beginning of the series. Did they never encourage that?
It seems like when this type of question comes up amongst friends, most friends warn of wrecking the friendship and advising against it, not saying, go for it. I just thought that was strange advice.
Yeah, and they use their own personal experience of saying like, well, we were friends and then we decided to date and now look at us. And I'm like,
I think the better advice is, take it easy. Just be yourself. Don't go out of your way on this. See what happens.
And Ted goes far out of his way this business.
He goes all in.
And I'm just like, is Emmett really that clueless? Like they have this incredibly romantic dinner where Ted lays it out all on the line.
Oh, under the circumstances, though, I think Ted dropped that bomb like in the best way that he could because he'd gone so far already.
You're the one who knows me better than anyone and still hasn't run away. Who tells me I'm adorable when I look like shit. Who, with his little finger, can lift my spirits even when they weigh 300 pounds. I love you, Emmett Honeycutt.
I don't think that there's a really great way to tell your best friend that you've fallen for him, though.
I know, but this was where it just went into that very almost sitcom-y world.
Yeah, screwball comedy.
Yeah.
The one thing that I bumped on here, too, is that I think, at least in the gay world, more times than not, this would start with a physical thing, not with a discussion. I think that gay men would position for sex versus like trying to say, I like you. I think you like me. We should consider dating. I think it's more like you just drunkenly start making out one night.
And you wake up the next day going, well, like, well, I guess we did that.
Let's give this a shot.
What does that mean?
Michael, though, as much as I was ragging on him in the last scene, he was pretty wise here. He said,
first you need to ask yourself if you have any feelings for him.
Well, sure, I have feelings for him. You know, warm feelings, fuzzy feelings, like I have for you, and Mel, and Linz, even Brian, sometimes. But not those kind of feelings.
Well, then you're just going to have to bite the bullet and tell him.
Which is interesting when you consider that his past is mostly an undiscussed infatuation with Brian. So Michael's given this advice, like, bite the bullet and tell him. Michael doesn't even do that in his own life.
Well, here's the thing, though. I think everyone knows how Michael feels about Brian. I don't think that's any secret either.
Yeah, at some point, this had to have come up, though, right?
Sure. I think everyone's just kind of like, well, we all know it, but nothing's going to happen with it, so.
Yeah, it's another case where oftentimes in the show, There's good lines written, but they go to the wrong character. There's like a better character that would have been more suited for that line.
And I feel like, where did these feelings develop? Because I felt like just in the last episode, Ted doesn't have anyone. He just unlocks something with Emmett.
Yeah, it did kind of come out of nowhere. It would have been nicer if, like, season one, it was Emmett that Ted was secretly into.
Yes, and then they sort of had to go their own separate because of Blake and then George Schickel and then because of George Schickel. That then it, like, that's where it starts to kind of unlock for Ted.
Yeah.
That, oh, maybe this is my opportunity. And then we have a couple more episodes to build up to this.
I don't know, though.
But here it was just like, huh, who's left? Emmett. I like him.
I don't know. And I've had moments in my life where all of a sudden I just look at somebody differently. I'd say I've got a pretty good batting average with it. It's about half and half about how well it works out. Sometimes it's like, what are you thinking? We're like BFFs. And then other times it's like, oh my God, I've always thought this about you, but I never wanted to say anything because I never wanted to blow our relationship. So I can see this coming out of nowhere, and I can see that Emmett, of all people, is never going to be like on the lookout for it. Ted is much more self-aware. So Ted's always going to be the one to be scoping out who can be next on that.
Absolutely.
The next day when Emmett and Ted meet up, and I thought this was like so awkward. Ted's watering the plants in his robe.
And singing opera and all that.
And it's really pathetic. Again, this little condo.
This whole sequence, I was just like, what the hell?
And something Emmett said was that I was up all night over this. That was a extreme. I chalk stuff like that up to bad writing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't be up all night thinking about that, Emmett. Seriously. Fall asleep. But he had a really graceful rejection for Ted. And I love it when we see some depth in Emmett instead of the like the 666 episode where he played the buffoon trying to help Michael. Like, I can make his meals, I can get his clothes. He was cast as like a ne'er-do-well, but here he had it together.
And the way Ted processes this rejection was very much like, oh, I know what you're going to say, because he's gone through it numerous times before. And he's like, I got to get to work. Mind closing up, by the way? It just leaves.
Yeah. Something I've learned in life is always not just let somebody say what they need to say, but force them to, and not jump in with words to fill their mouths with or try to fill in the blanks. You have to give people the space to say that themselves. You have to force them to say it themselves. Otherwise, you're kind of casting it.
Yes. Well, and then we finally get to...
Because after all, Emmett might have been heading towards let's play this by ear and see what happens without making a big proclamation about it.
Yes.
But
he didn't
give Ted that chance. Ted didn't give him that chance.
Yes, because Ted ended the dinner with saying, I love you, Emmett, honey. And it's like, what?
Kept him up all night.
Yeah, so it could have been that Emmett's like, let's see, again, like you said, like, let's see where this goes. I can't say that I love you because this is very new to me.
Yeah, but Emmett never said it. Yeah. We don't know how Emmett felt.
Yeah, Ted cuts everything off, because then I think, if that's the case, what happens at Babylon when they finally confront each other?
Yeah.
It helps make a little more sense, because I was thinking, wait a minute. So Emmett is like saying all these things to build Ted up and make him feel better. And then they just kind of succumb to the feelings.
Well, that follow-up awkwardness is really spot on. If you've ever embarrassed yourself in front of somebody, the next time you see them is always like, hi.
Hey.
Yeah. This ending, though, I thought was a little too predictable, that Emmett started to see Ted romantically, but all
Very
by the end
convenient.
Of one episode. Because once again, it's just too easy. There was almost no obstruction in the path to that climax. So they just didn't have to work hard enough at it.
No, they got what they needed. Or at least Ted got what he wanted.
So let's wrap up this episode. Timeliness. I gave this one a 3. Couldn't really pick out anything in the episode that's changed in the 17 years since this episode aired. I think it could air now and you wouldn't know the difference.
Sure. I gave it a 4.
Ooh.
I think just to bump up, I actually really like how the relationship triangle question comes into play here, because I think it's something that happens in open relationships where you take the risk of saying, all right, we opened it up, but who knows what could happen outside of it.
For information accuracy, I gave this one a 3. Again, nothing out of whack here. Mostly because the stories were so deeply character driven. It wasn't a preachy episode the way that some of the HIV episodes are. So there's nothing all that inaccurate about it.
Yeah, I agree. I gave it a 3 as well. Inoffensive, focused on the characters, which was fine by me. I find episodes of this show when it focuses more on the character in a more complex way, a lot more enjoyable.
For relatability, I gave this one 5. I thought this episode was a home run. With Justin, we see him wrestling with a life of luxury, but no romance with Brian, against a life of squalor, but full of passion with Ethan. I think dating a close friend has crossed everyone's mind on some level. That story was told very accurately. I didn't really like the way that Michael and Ben's story played out, but I definitely can relate to those discussions that couples have when they're planning or talking about a longish separation. That's basically the story of my life. How long are we going to be apart this time?
I gave it a 4. I would have given it a 5 if the runner of Emmett and Ted wasn't just tidied up so easily. It just kind of bugged me that, like, on one hand, I understand that the falling for a friend is totally something that happens. Just the ease in which they both, the way it kind of came together, just, I didn't buy into that.
I guess that could be almost a mini cliffhanger too, though, because all we did was see them make out. It's not like they went home and fucked.
I wish they would have left it at just before them making out.
Yeah, like looking into each other's eyes.
Going like, wait a minute, what's going to happen?
Yeah, that would have been so good.
Instead, they just gave into it.
Yeah. Stick your tongue in his mouth. So that's our verdict on the season 2 finale, Out with a Whimper.
Next time, Brian and Justin move on after breaking up.
Michael and Ben discuss living together.
Mel and Lindsay talk about having another child.
That will be the debut episode of season 3, and it's called Mad Dog Kinney. We are still Queer as Folk. Please rate and or review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us, and subscribe. It really means a lot to us, and it does help more people find our show.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF, and you can also like us on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
And of course, if you want to connect with us personally, and I hope you do, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall, no E's.
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Matthew PD.
Thanks for joining us for season 1 and 2. This has been a real ride emotionally for us.
Very much so.
And we're glad that you're with us. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
We'll see you next time. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez.
New episodes every Wednesday as we take apart the show one episode at a time.
Available now on iTunes,
Google Play,
Stitcher,
TuneIn,
Overcast,
Pocket Cast, and all your other favorite podcatchers.
Still, Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.